President-elect Barack Obama and his family are getting ready for their move into the White House. And we will use the opportunity to talk with someone who probably knows more than anyone about everything about the White House, including the history made there, the traditions that have come and gone, and the mark the various presidents have had on the White House. We will welcome your questions and maybe your own stories about the White House. Maybe you visited there. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We are happy to have with us historian William Seal. He is author of The President's House, A History, a revised and expanded history of the White House. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's a pleasure to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
When we set up this interview last week, I was looking forward to having the weekend to go through your book. What I didn't know at the time is that I wasn't going to be able to even put a dent in it. This is an elegant two-volume set, each book about 700 pages, complete with photographs. This was quite the undertaking, wasn't it?
Well, it was, and it's all documented, of course, and it's a history. I mean, it's a history of each administration up to the first George Bush. That's as recently as I could get documentation. And so it's a documented history of the White House.
Yeah, and
the only one.
And how were you able to tell this story? So you just went from administration to administration?
Well, yes, that was the only way to do it. But it's catch as catch can. The White House is beautifully documented, and a lot of the documents, I'd say most of the ones about the building itself, are in the National Archives here in Washington, are in their storage, because every president, of course, lives there, is more or less required to live there, and is scrutinized while there. And from the very start, there was always an effort to review his papers when he left to see if maybe there was some irregularity, like a pool table bought out of public money or something that might make news. And so presidents have been extremely careful to be very accurate with the records of the White House.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a wonderful resource. And then you have the presidential papers, which are a piece of cake today because of the 11 presidential libraries. They didn't have those before. And presidential papers are likely, like Washington's, for example, are likely to be scattered everywhere. So you kind of go after those and take what you can find. And new things turn up all the time.
Well, we won't probably be able to talk about everything that's in the book during this hour, but we can at least skim the highlights. Let's start at the beginning. Who was the first president to live in the White House?
John Adams, but it was built by George Washington.
And
never
why?
Lived there.
Yeah.
It was built according to his specifications.
Yeah. Tell us how this all began.
An amendment to the Constitution called for a federal city in 1790 in Washington and gave 10 years in which it was to be built. There was no town there. It was a new site. And it called for a house for Congress and a house for the president, which was commonly called the palace. Well, normally in those days, the Secretary of State would have handled the building. But Washington took it on personally because he was more interested in having a city than a town. Thomas Jefferson, Secretary of State, wanted just a village. An official village that would be more or less vacated between when Congress was not in session and simply a little working place. Washington wanted a city like Paris that was the capital in the political sense and the economic sense. So he undertook to make all approvals himself, and he allowed the plan for Washington today, which was very ambitious and very modern in its time, a city that was both a symbolic capital and a working city. Then the public buildings were made subject to his approval. And the White House, first he approved a building five times the size of the house that's there today, and the cellars were dug, and the building was not begun because of complications, and he then approved the house that's there. Not only approved it, but he was a surveyor, and he went and drove the stakes in the ground for exactly where it stands, which was kind of in this huge cellar, much bigger than it was. And he saw it finished, more or less finished. It looked like it. He would recognize it if he saw it today.
Yeah. When John Adams, though, moved in, George Washington's portrait it says here was, you know, hanging there, and George Washington was had passed away.
He had died. Mm-hmm. He died with the 18th century, right before Christmas 1799. And Adams moved in the following November of 1800, as specified in the amendment to the Constitution. He moved in November the 1st, as the Constitution said. The house was not finished inside. I mean, again, it looked like it looks, but there was no great staircase. A lot of the rooms weren't plastered, and he sort of camped out in it. It was Jefferson who brought it nearer to completion. It wasn't actually completed till about 1830, mm-hmm. having been burned in between in the British invasion.
Right. How big was the White House when it first opened?
About 60 rooms, if you counted everything. There was the basement, it was a walkout basement on the back, and then ground level on the front, and then the main floor where the state rooms, the blue room, and all that are. And then one floor above that and an attic. So that it was about 60 rooms.
And how does that compare to what it's like today?
Oh, well, it's about 140 rooms today.
So
and it was remodeled, you know, to the walls in 1948 to 52 after World War II by President Truman. And the interior was rebuilt, but because technology had changed, steel could be used and your walls did not need to be so thick. So just the stone walls were saved and lined with a steel skeleton, and it gave lots more space. While the formal rooms and state rooms are the size they always were, they were able to get bathrooms and chaises in and all sorts of stuff to create a much, much bigger house in 52, a much more functioning house.
We are talking with William Seal. He is author of The President's House, A History. It's a two-set volume, a revised and expanded comprehensive history of the White House. We welcome your questions about the White House and the history that was made in the most famous house in the nation. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's coming up on 19 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, November the 17th. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins between 4 and 6. After 5, Ben's guest talks about Democratic National Committee Chair Howard Dean, his change of image since last year, his legacy as party leader who built a new grassroots movement and a bridge between one generation and the next. That's Howard Dean, the subject after 5 o'clock during At Issue with Ben Marins. Our subject during this hour is the White House, or the President's House. Our author is William Seal. He is author of this two-set volume of history, The President's House, A History, talking about the stories behind the nation's most famous home and the presidents who help shape it. We welcome your questions about how the White House was built and how it has evolved over the years, and traditions that have come and gone, the history that was made there. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We have a caller who has a question, Monique in Sugar Grove. Hi, Monique, you're on the air.
Greetings. Thank you for taking my call. I'm sure that writing this book was quite an undertaking, given the history.
Well, yes.
I'm sure. I'm wondering if you spent any time regarding the construction of the White House and any role of slavery with that.
Oh, yes. That's the first part of the book. That was, in fact, one of the most interesting parts to me, because I was able to trace the builders, the stonemasons, and the various builders, and to Scotland, and many were from abroad, and Europe had exploded in war. Many of them left illegally. Slaves were used in the early period of building the White House, not so much in the later period. The European workmen didn't like working with slaves because the slaves were under the control of businessmen, masters, their owners. Therefore, they would be learning the trades and then going out and hiring, being hired out to exercise these trades as competition. This is something that the guilds had always taken care of in Europe, and while they didn't have slavery, it was the guilds were very, very controlled, and all of these workmen had been in guilds, the stonemasons, for example, in Scotland, and so they opposed the use of slaves. Slaves were hired from their masters. But the original work, the bringing the stones to the from the quarry up the Potomac to the site, a lot, some of the cutting, the brick making, slaves were involved in all of that up until, well, pretty much toward the top of the house before the roof was put on.
Yep. Anything else, Monique?
No, it's just a fascinating component to consider given the upcoming administration that will be in the House. So I thank you for highlighting that.
Sure.
That's true. We've come a long way, haven't we, William Seale?
Yeah. Well, Joy, you mentioned earlier the house being built. Who built the house? Washington built the house. But I do want to add that every president has utter authority over the building. It was not even made a National Historic Landmark for that reason. Now, the president has to get the money to do it, and Congress is not very generous with the White House historically. But the president can do anything he wants to the White House.
Now, what are some of the maybe some of the significant or notable changes that presidents made when they moved into the White House?
Well, the most, you know, to begin with, I'd like to preface it by saying it's not like moving into your house or my house. It's a house of the busiest person in the world,
mm-hmm.
extremely busy, and it's very unusual when they have time to give much thought to it at all. It's a working house, and it's always has to conform to the purpose the president sees in it. Probably the most contentious of all White House occupants in terms of building was President Truman, Harry Truman. He he really did a lot. He built the Truman Balcony in defiance because Congress would not fund an addition to the West Wing. He used household funds to build the Truman Balcony, which, as a matter of fact, is an architectural disaster, but the tenants of the house always love it because it gives them their only patio. He then, they were having some structural difficulties with the house, and he just took the bull by the horns, and Congress did support this. And from 1948 to 52, just gutted it to the stone walls, the original stone walls, and rebuilt it, a new house inside. It looks like the old one, but it's not. Off of the public areas, it's a different house.
Mm-hmm.
And Truman did that. And in a way, you have to look back. What they were afraid of was firebombing and all sorts of things. They just emerged from the war that sort of thing. But he preserved the house as the president's house for all time. And it was after Truman that the House became a television icon. So the fact that the president could stay there and live there is because of the Truman renovations. And Truman did that on his own. Some presidents wouldn't have done it.
Yeah. Well, so it was important for Truman to have a balcony.
Well, very. I mean, for his own use, but more importantly, as he rebuilt the House, where it was usable in a modern period.
Mm-hmm. What are some other changes that other presidents put in place?
Well, Jefferson, the building had outbuildings like a farm all in the yard, and Jefferson united them all in the east and west wings. And so you didn't see them from the street, or at least they looked like extensions of the house. Theodore Roosevelt came in 1902 and presented with the option of tearing it down, or rather expanding it, had it restored. And the office up to that time had always been in the house, and he moved it into what we know as the West Wing. So that was a change, but it's that kind of rethinking change that's so important. And Theodore Roosevelt's changes really still control the setup or the layout of the White House today with the West Wing, which, of course, has expanded into many other buildings. But the West Wing is the basic core of the president's operation. And it is connected on the west to the house, as Theodore Roosevelt made it.
Yeah.
So those are the main changes of that. And, of course, one would have to say a major decision was Madison, after the British burned the house in 1814, James Madison's decision to build it back exactly as it had been, as a symbol of survival. So that was a major decision. A goodly number of people in the government wanted to move the capital to Cincinnati.
Who wanted to move it to Cincinnati?
To Cincinnati. That was the center of the United States. Mm-hmm. They figured the public buildings were burned. Why stay in Washington? Because it was a sorry town anyway. I mean, nobody really wanted to live there. So the idea was Cincinnati was the booming queen of the West, and it was on the Ohio, connected to the Mississippi. You could go all across the United States and go by Cincinnati's door. So why not put the government there? And it didn't happen. The capital was kept where it was, and part of the anchoring was public buildings.
Besides the British burning the White House in 1814, were there other tumultuous times for the White House like that?
Not really, no. That was, of course, the worst. It was really the low point in White House history. The House had its problems beginning after the Civil War with different elements, notably the Corps of Army Engineers wanted to build a new house. A modern house in very extensive grounds that could be protected, but the public wouldn't hear of it, and Congress wouldn't give them a nickel. So people have been able to remodel, like Theodore Roosevelt in 1902 and Truman in 50 years later, but it's been pretty sacrosanct. I think the reason for that is that Lincoln lived there. The whole melodrama, you know, of Lincoln's life, his private life, and his public life really took place in that house. That's the stage. And people were very aware of that already, very soon after his death. And I think that that's what made the house rather sacred. It might have gone. The Victorian age, you know, was pretty indelible in what they did. But that house survived it. And many plans for expansion, it survived. And I think it was the Lincoln aspect, the fact that he had lived there and that story. It's just as familiar to every American as anything, as a nursery rhyme even. It took place there, and it's dramatized by the presence of the house.
Yeah. Well, we have just a minute before we take a news break. We had a caller who did want to know, can Barack Obama change the White House? And you mentioned, yes, he could, but the Congress has to approve the money to do that?
Either that or he raises it privately. For instance, President Nixon, well, President Kennedy, and the renovation work decorating they did inside the house was done with private money. They went and raised the money in various ways, donations for the historic White House, and far more so in a far bigger level was the Nixon work, which really reemphasized the Kennedy work, but with much finer contents. And antiques and things that were worth millions and millions were bought entirely with private money. Not a penny of public money went into it. So Barack Obama, when he becomes president, could change anything he wants to if he can get the money to do it. And whether he would take the time to bother with that, I doubt it. Radical change. The White House works very well.
He wants other sorts of change. Thanks very much. We will we'll check news, and then we'll continue talking with William Seal, who is author of The President's House, A History. And we'll welcome your questions for him after this news. We are talking about our house, actually the president's house, the White House, this hour, with a guest who says that no other building better reflects the nation's history. As President-elect Barack Obama and his family prepare to move into the White House, we will take a look back at the most famous house in the nation, some of the significant events that took place there, how key presidents shaped its history, the evolution of the White House, and some of the traditions that have come and gone. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 6:36 on this Monday, November the 17th. We welcome your questions for our guest, historian William Seal, the author of a revised and expanded comprehensive history of the White House called The President's House, A History. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. William Steele, when was the last time that the White House had a major remodeling or any kind of extensive changes?
Major changes would be 48 to 52.
And
it's always being repaired. They have a crew working all the time because it's used so hard. But major remodeling would be that long ago, yes.
It is. I thought one recent administration, maybe even, I'm trying to remember, did some remodeling, though, where we're kind of giving it a facelift to modernize it a little bit.
But you're probably thinking about the cleaning of the walls, cleaning the paint off of the walls. It took 20 years.
It took 20 years to do that?
And the paint, about 50 coats of paint were taken off the walls, and the walls were then prepared and repaired. And the big scars were still on them from the fire, and then they were repainted.
Mm-hmm.
It's not actually white. It's sort of a yellow color. But it's repainted. Now, that was a major project that Jimmy Carter started in the Carter administration, and it was finished during the Clinton administration.
Wow, that did take a long time.
But you know, one thing I'd like to say about the White House and relate it to something else. I worked on a project there in Wisconsin, not too far from you, called Ten Chimneys.
Yes, I do remember that.
Well, public radio was very generous to us in that whole project. That was a most unusual project. It was the home of the famous Broadway stars, Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontanne. It was exactly as they left it. Her false eyelashes were still on her dressing table.
My goodness.
The books they had been reading, everything was still there. It was a matter of conserving it and bringing it back. One of the most fascinating things I've ever been involved in. All I could think of was King Tut's tomb. Every time I went in there with the letters still in the drawers, everything they owned. The White House is not like that at all. It's a much resorted house. It's emptied and refilled and emptied and refilled and reset like a stage over time. In fact, it's more an idea in many ways than it is a real house. An architectural historian would have a lot of trouble doing much work on what is remaining except for the stone walls, unless he wanted a history of a house built from 1948 to 52.
Interesting.
And yet it is the same house. You can sit in the blue room with the doors closed, as I have, and imagine the Madisons in their flight, and Dolly Madison looking out the south windows toward the smoke, the British cannons in the distance coming up to the White House, and realize it was but the walls of 1952. The floors have been changed twice since 1952 because they wore out, and it's a house in a constant state of change, and yet that image remains the same, and the image rather gelled following the Truman administration, more, I think, an accident than by intention, because while President Truman lived across the street at Blair House and the house was being remodeled, television came into its own, really the same period, 48 through the early 50s, and the White House quickly became an icon on television. And so it's an icon to the world, that image, that unchanging and timeless image of the American presidency and, as your caller said, of American history.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that you think of the image as much with the White House as anything, and every president is going to make it work for the work he has to do there.
Yeah, I guess the image that comes to mind when I think of the White House, besides that exterior, is the Oval Office. Talk some about the history there. Was that there from the beginning?
No, the Oval Office was not even there when Roosevelt built the West Wing. Theodore Roosevelt built the West Wing. His successor, President Taft, built it, and he selected the oval shape only because of the oval rooms in the White House were so familiar, the Blue Room. See, they had a little problem with that West Wing. Congressmen and senators and people didn't want to meet with the president there. They didn't think it was an official place. They insisted on meeting in the House. So the President Roosevelt always met with these people in the House. Well, Taft liked a very organized office situation. Roosevelt was not very organized, but Taft was, and he had a very modern office idea, point of view. And so he put this in so people would meet there and think of it as official. It was set in the West Wing. Then when the West Wing was remodeled in 1934, President Franklin Roosevelt built another Oval Office using some of the parts and moved it over even closer to the White House. So it forms a sort of a U-shape with the House and the Rose Garden in between and the Oval Office. And it is now, of course, one of the most famous spaces in the White House. It was always just a working space before, really, the Kennedy administration, not so much. I think Nixon, the Nixon administration, is when the Oval Office really became more ceremonial than it had ever been before.
So how did the Rose Garden also become a place where there were always presidential speeches or proclamations coming from the Rose Garden?
Well, the Rose Garden is adjacent to the Oval Office and the side of the White House. If you were in the state dining room, you'd look down into it. It had many uses in history, and Mrs. Woodrow Wilson created the first Rose Garden there, and just because it looked bad looking down from the bedrooms, and she made it attractive. Of course, she died early. But it continued on, and in the Eisenhower administration, Eisenhower began having presentations out there of Boy Scouts, anything from Boy Scouts to garden clubs to vets to whatever. And they made the flower beds smaller, and they could take 500 or 600 people standing there. And Eisenhower could walk out of the Oval Office, spend about 10 minutes, and go back to work. Yeah. That was the object of it. Well, in the Kennedy administration, this was really formalized with the creation of the garden we know today.
Mm-hmm.
There's steps from the porch outside the Oval Office and the cabinet that are big enough to hold a lectern and a microphone. And so the crowd gathers there. They come in up the driveway and gather in on the lawn there. And the president comes out and makes the presentation and a few nice remarks. And he goes back to work, and everyone disperses, gets a cup of punch or something, and disperses. And the grass is kept in perfect shape because there's a grass farm over in Maryland. And every time it gets worn out and patches in it, a little patch is put back of fresh grass. So it's a working space of the White House. It just doesn't have a roof.
We have a caller. Kip in Twin Lakes joins us now. Hi, Kip.
Hi there. How are you today?
Good. Go ahead.
I have two questions. First off, did your book have to go through any government agency to be sure that it didn't have to be a classified book, such as a secret or confidential eyes only?
No, it didn't. It
and
did
my
not.
Second question.
The only thing the one thing I would say that there was a, I found it rather funny. There was a wing President Truman wanted to build to the West Wing. Was never built. Congress refused to fund it. That's why Truman built his balcony, to kind of thumb his nose at Congress. Well, the plan of the West Wing I wanted to use in the book, and the Secret Service wouldn't release it. I never quite understood that.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense, yeah.
No, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. No, I had no problem with that at all. And security is an issue in the book. Security was always an issue with the White House from the very start.
Wow. I also was wondering if you have anything about myths of the White House, such as rumors that there's special tunnels that lead from the White House to a certain area in the city, or that there's the basement is really not, it's deeper than it really looks, and so forth. Do you have anything on that?
The last part's true. The original house had a basement that is, after 1902, was renamed the ground floor. It's where the kitchens and everything were, and the kitchen still is. But then in the Truman renovations, they went below the basement in a sub-basement. And you remember in 9/11, some of the people at the White House went for safety into a subterranean room, and that's what it is. There are no tunnels. There's less secret about the White House than you can imagine. How I would have loved it in the book had there been panels I could tell about that you touched, and they opened to corridors that went around. There was nothing, our pictures with the eyes punched out, but there was nothing like that in the house. There was, in 1942, immediately, early in the year, Pearl Harbor had just happened, Roosevelt authorized the building of an expansion to the East Wing. Now, beneath that was a bomb shelter, a gloomy, gloomy room that's not used anymore except for storing chairs and tables. But President Roosevelt went down in it one time and said, "Get me out of here." And so that was there. And for a while before that, there was a temporary shelter in the cellars of the Treasury building next door that went, it didn't do much. It went to the areaway around the Treasury, and then you ran across the open air to get into it. But it worked temporarily, and there was a little, I guess you would call it a tunnel, but it was above ground. It was earth over it. But otherwise, the White House doesn't have that kind of secrets, really.
We will talk about what the White House does have and how it's changed over its 200-some-year history. William Seal, our guest, author of The President's House, A History. 1-800-642-1234. Anything that you've been wanting to know about the White House that you've been afraid to ask? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're tuned to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's about 11 minutes before 7 o'clock on this Monday, November the 17th. Coming up after 7, an anticipated $5 billion budget deficit is the 800-pound gorilla lurking at the state capitol. In our state capitol report, I'll talk with a guest about the options the state has for digging out of a $5 billion hole. That's coming up after 7 o'clock. Right now, we are talking about the White House and the history of the White House and how the White House has evolved and some of the significant events that have taken place at the White House. Our guest knows a lot about the President's House. That's the name of his updated and revised and expanded History of the White House. His name is William Seal. And our number, if you have a question, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. William Seal, you mentioned to our last caller, no secret tunnels in the White House and that sort of thing. We do have an email from Saul in Stevens Point, who wonders if any major changes were made to the White House, or changes in general have made to the White House, in response to security threats like 9/11.
Well, yes. I mean, the whole issue, it's bigger than 9/11, but the whole security issues at the White House really became tighter and tighter after 1976, the attempts on President Ford's life, when they began trying to get the president not to do things locally, to do everything at the White House. And the White House became as busy as a railroad hotel after that, things going on all the time, constantly. Luncheons, speeches, presentations, but the more they can have done at the White House, it's easier to protect the president. And as time has gone by, with other issues and events coming up, security-oriented things, they've tried to take vehicular traffic farther and farther from the House. President Clinton finally and very reluctantly approved closing Pennsylvania Avenue, which has really been very nice, as it's turned out. And probably in the future, more and more streets will be closed in the area. Because the big issue is to keep the White House. Nobody wants the president to move, much less the president. He certainly doesn't want to move. As Taft once said, this is a very useful place. And so it's, security is a major issue there. But again, in many ways, it always has been. James Monroe had sharpshooters in 1818 walking around the edge of the roof during every public occasion. It's always been a problem through the years. But today, with technology, what it is of terror, protection is pretty sophisticated around the White House.
Did the bunker or subterranean room that people went to after the 9/11 attacks, was that something that's been there for a very long time, you say?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked, actually. That's interesting. President Truman, there's one. You don't find much in writing about spaces like that. And it isn't a room. It's a whole floor with the 7-foot-thick walls. And it's built just to use every day, you know, in the whatever they needed for the White House, but to be there in case. And of course, bomb shelters are archaic now. But when they were putting in the foundations of the under the stone walls for the rebuilding of the interior, President Truman issued an order that $750,000 would be taken out of the National Park Service budget to do work at the White House. Well, that's what it was. It was to dig that extra basement and put those huge thick walls in it and vaults and thick ceilings riddled with steel, laced with steel, to offer protection for household staff in the event of bombs or fire bombs or airplane attacks or anything like that. It's amazing through time how it hits you doing the research how there have been periods of great fear there. During World War II, there's a letter Mrs. Roosevelt wrote to her daughter, Anna, And she says, Father expects there to be bombing in Los Angeles and San Francisco this summer. And you think, if I put that in a script, no one would believe
right,
it.
Right, yeah.
But, yes, it was very just a matter-of-fact statement to her daughter, a private letter.
Back to the phones, Karen in Cumberland is with us. Hi, Karen.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm curious about the number of people that are typically in the White House at any given time, and the number of people that are the staff that attends the first family.
Okay, there is a domestic staff at the White House of about 30. It varies. And then for big dinners, sometimes extra people are brought in that they know, often retired people who used to work there. Then there's a ground staff, there's a staff, I mean, there's even a plumber full-time, and a painter, two painters, and a carpentry shop. And I guess if you added all of that up, it would be about 80 people. And you don't see them all the time because there are various areas they're in, but they're in the grounds, within the grounds. And then there's a large Secret Service detail there, and to the house, and then, of course, attached to the cars, which go through that, through the Secret Service. And the family's privacy is largely restricted to their quarters, of course, on the second and third floors. And they're pretty quiet. They remind me very much of two floors cordoned off in a hotel with big rooms and are comfortable. But privacy is a real luxury for a first family, as I guess it's always been for heads of state through history. And a lot of that is Camp David, when they're able to go there on weekends and really let their hair down.
Other callers, Jim in Onalaska. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Say, I've seen all these different programs, of course, since Obama became president-elect, but about the White House, and there's various stuff on TV. But having been to Washington, D.C. a couple times, the whole property itself that's surrounded by the gate that you can walk around, it doesn't seem very big, but yet it seems to have all of these ultra gardens and everything else in it. How big is the property that the White House sits on, really?
18 acres.
Oh, my goodness, that big. It certainly doesn't appear to be that big.
But it originally was 85, and the White House still has jurisdiction basically over those 85. The idea was it would be like an estate off from town. And first, they built the executive office buildings there. George Washington ordered that. They never intended that, but the Congress wanted to put all the government workers up near the Congress, and the Congress wasn't there but a few months a year. So the president said they need to be where the work goes on every day. And it's gone that way. Jefferson whacked it down to about 6 acres, and it was enlarged later under General Grant into about what it is today, about 18 acres.
You know, we heard stories of pranks taking place, or maybe even worse than that, like when the Clinton administration left and the Bush administration came in, like taking letters off keyboards and that sort of thing. Is that the only documented case of something like that happening?
No. Mm-hmm. No, as staff has gotten big, and I would say since the middle 20th century, the whole idea of I worked here, it's a great moment in my life, and I want a souvenir. They have to change the doorknobs in the executive office building. Many of them are taken by staff members for souvenirs because they have the emblem on them, you know, of the War and Navy. And it's the whole souvenir mentality. It's not vandalism, really, and I'm sure at the time it seems perfectly natural. They'll say this is the last chance I'll ever have. But, you know, realizing that a person who works at the White House, that is a high point in their lives, and they'll always remember it. They'll always have those pictures of themselves shaking hands with the president in their dens and playrooms and such as that. And that's the extent of it. Sometimes it gets in the papers and it's a little confusing. It seems more important than it is.
Danny in Eau Claire is with us. Hi, Danny.
Hi, good morning. Liking the program so far. Just wanted to ask, actually, that was a nice segue into my question. I had a political science professor at Eau Claire tell me that Jimmy Carter put on solar panels on the top of the house only to have the Reagan administration take them down. And I was kind of wondering if there's any other time in history that something like that's happened between two presidents.
Well, the president is correct. I mean, your professor is correct that they were costing a vast amount of money to run. The solar panels never really worked very well economically. So the cost was the reason they were removed. They were put in, and with every good Every with good cheer on all sides, but they didn't work. So that's why they were taken down. Thinking of what's undone, done by one and undone by another, I can only think of little things that don't matter, really, of decorative things or that kind of stuff, which is a president's prerogative to do. No, that I can think of offhand, and after this show, I will think of something.
That's all right. We only have about a minute or so to go, so Danny called at the very end of the program. I heard people saying, presidents who, a lot of your recreation is done there. Is there a basketball court so Barack Obama can...
No, but there will be. There will be, and they'll find a place for it. They spoon things in. Everybody's a president. The White House exists to make the president's job easy and work well. President Ford's exercise was swimming. They put in a swimming pool. Mrs. Kennedy liked a trampoline. She had a trampoline. And President Clinton jogged, and they put a little jogging path, a soft path, all along the edge of the driveway. You hardly notice it. President Eisenhower's golf green was remodeled under President Clinton.
There'll likely be a basketball court. Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. William Seal, author of The President's House, A History. Thanks to Carmen Jackson and to Cynthia Schuster for producing this program. Thanks to Bill Martins and Cynthia for on-air production and direction. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Ideas Network.